food journalism encompasses so many different things. And with the evolution of food culture in this country, it has taken on a whole new life. I mean, it's very dynamic, it's growing, it's going in all kinds of different directions. And so what I'm gonna do now with our panelists is ask them to, you know, sort of think about all of these concepts, but then to really come up with a definition or at least a framework that we can think about as we develop stories about food. So I guess I would start with each of you to give, you know, what is your thumbnail definition of what is food journalism? Zahir, you want to start?
Thank you. So I guess there's no, I sort of came to food journalism late. And so part of, I think, when we started our podcast, Soleil, who's a chef, I was primarily a print journalist. We were actually frustrated with the way food journalism was. So on this, the list behind me, I would add words like humiliation, erasure, marginalization. And our podcast was born out of feeling humiliated. I'll give you an example. I was living in Portland, Oregon when we started our podcast, and there was a review of an Indian restaurant. And the restaurant is owned by Sikhs. And the stupid reviewer went on about how, you know, Sikhs worship cows, which they don't. But it's not even relevant to the article. Just tell us if the food is good. And so much of our podcast at least started by saying, let's respond to these words. And so for us, for me, food journalism is a way to center these stories around people of color, around immigrants, or around marginalized groups. So I do think what I think with food journalism, and I think Anthony Bourdain was so great about this, was that he was very fair, but he had a very, very, very strong point of view. And that, to me, is sort of our philosophy. We try to be fair. We try to talk to as many people as possible. But we have a very, very strong point of view. And so now, as we're freelancing and we're looking for pitches, like, that's what we look for most. So I think I see food journalism as not sort of a form of activism, but I think what we're seeing today with some of the best food writers, like Tejal Rao in the New York Times and others, is, I think, a sort of correction. A lot of these books that have been neglected are being resurrected and saying, or let's say we're doing a whole series on the erasure of Black Americans from barbecue. And so you see these, like, you know, David Chang series about, you know, barbecue, but very few Black Americans are being interviewed. So our way of sort of saying is, how do we sort of recenter these stories around the people where it should have been about them in the first place? So that to me is what we try to do with our food journalism. And even in the articles that I write, I think, how do I rewrite a story? So I love taking a subject that's been written about to death and sort of troll food media by writing it in a way that's a little bit more respectful. So I just wrote a piece for Bon Appetit magazine about the supermarket that's been written about so many times in Columbus, Ohio, but people have not focused about how the place is really a space for refugees. And I didn't want to just write about this market as an, oh, this is the best place to get momos, and the momos are amazing, and I love momos. But let's also talk about, for refugee communities, this place means something. And so that's the sort of piece, and I was very fortunate that Bon Appetit let me write that story.
Super gigantic question. I guess the word that stuck out for me is connection. I find, when I was pregnant and first had my first daughter, I found that being a parent or about to become a parent was this massive connection with humanity. Like in an elevator, there was a 60-year-old guy and he's showing me pictures of his grandkids and it's like, oh, I have nothing to say to you, but now we do because I'm gonna have a child. And I feel that way about food, that it is the one thing that everybody does every single day. So how do we use it to connect to each other? And I like to think that at its best, food journalism makes those connections. you know, I could even be in a room with a Republican and think I have to run away, but then we could start to talk about cornbread. Or somebody tells me, you know, there's this truck down the street that you should really try, and we're connecting, and we're not getting into the minutia of how we don't agree on anything in the world except maybe that food truck. So I like to see it as a connective tissue between humans that are alike and not alike, and I feel that it is just an incredible way to tell stories about humanity. I think I'll leave it at that.
So I stumbled into food journalism, didn't even know I was doing it, because I have always been interested in food in our home, because that's where we interact with it, that's where we experience it most often. And so I've always been interested in how we feed ourselves and our families and our people at home. So it was sort of inevitable when I started working in food journalism that I got into what we call service journalism. and it's that space where we are sharing recipes and we're teaching people how to grocery shop and to use their budget, because that's where we can help people through food. And what happened is that actually opens up an entire world of other types of storytelling. Every single word that we have up here pertains to the food that you eat in your home. And so for me, food journalism is providing service, to be of use to other people, to provide confidence and elevate stories, and especially stories that make people feel like themselves through food, but specifically in their home. And I avoid saying that I work in the cooking space, because cooking is one part of food. What I'm really interested in is in people feeding themselves and feeding each other. And when you use that language, that means that food doesn't just have to nourish you physically, that it can nourish you in other different ways. And so when I think of journalism, and I think of food journalism in particular, I think about being fed, and I think of service. And that is just like, I don't know, it's just such an invitation to all different types of stories for me.
I love what all of y'all have said, and that all really resonates with me. I also think that I came to food journalism to fill in the gaps. I felt like for a long time, I actually started in reporting, focusing exclusively on immigrants, immigrant communities, social justice, racial justice issues, and not food at all. But I, again, think about food all the time and find it this really rich environment for telling stories. And I, you know, I found fairly quickly that there were all these kind of big gaps, to what Zahir was saying, between one aspect of a community and the story that was being told about them. And one specific example I can give to that is, you know, I write a lot about Puerto Rican food and I write about Caribbean food. And I kept finding that with West Indian food, Jamaican food, Trinidadian food, you do hear about the African roots of those culinary cultures. But when it came to food from my homeland, from Puerto Rico, I almost never saw it described or articulated in relation to the African ancestors who were brought to Puerto Rico and they're enslaved. And the ingredients, techniques, that they used that subsequently became a part of our culinary culture. I wasn't seeing that conversation. And I think there are a lot of reasons why, but when I had the tremendous privilege to start doing my own reporting and to write a book, that was the place where I felt like I needed to start. It was like, there's a big hole here. As a scholar, and as a scholar who also happens to be journalistically trained, you know, you're told over and over again to pitch a fresh angle, right? And I think like that buzzword actually means look for the story that's not being told at all and fill in the gap with your voice. And if you also happen to have the privilege to be of the community that that voice is speaking from, then it gives you an additional point of connection or background, you know. I think a huge part of food writing, sort of what you were saying, Hallie, like starts in your own kitchen, starts in like noticing the things that you keep in your pantry that you maybe don't understand. Another quick example is there's a super popular dessert in Puerto Rico called tembleque, which is ultimately, it's a vegan coconut pudding. It is the simplest thing in the world. It literally has four ingredients: coconut milk, cornstarch, sugar, and orange flower water. Actually, five ingredients. It has some salt. Yes. And orange flower water, I cannot tell you for the life of me why on earth that ingredient is in this recipe. It's not used anywhere else in Puerto Rican food. It is found exclusively, at least in my experience, in three places. I learned recently, Amazon, on the internet, you can find it. Botanicas, which for those of y'all who aren't familiar with botanicas, are spiritual, cultural spaces, particularly for folks who have African diasporic faith bases, and then Middle Eastern supply stores. And I have not yet written the article about orange flower water, but it was one of many places in my own kitchen where I was like, you know, like, well, what is that about? And that kind of curiosity, I think, those are the places where you fill in the gaps. And you don't have to be of that culture to fill in those gaps, right? You just need to be open-minded and super curious about why things happen that you don't understand or haven't been told before.
So, Vaughn, you're talking about voice, and I want to talk more about voice in a moment, but first I want to go back to something that Hallie and Zahir talked about. So, Hallie, you talked about service, and Zahir, you talked about fairness. And my question is, and those are sort of bedrock principles of traditional journalism. And I wonder if food journalism, in your view, is subject to the same ethical standards, the same standards of fact-checking, of truthfulness, of reliability, and so forth, that other forms of journalism are supposed to be subject to, but of course we know is all being called into question in this era of fake news. But I mean, for those of us who still believe that there is a difference between, that there is some, if there's not truth, there's the honest desire to seek the truth, if food journalism falls into that tradition, or is it something, because it's so personal, you're allowed to be more opinionated and perhaps less fact-based and less service-based than other forms of journalism?
I can answer that. I mean, I think it goes without saying, but here we are and I'll say it, is that like if you're standing in your integrity when you're doing your work, then you're doing the right thing. I mean, I work on the internet where I write titles that might feel like clickbait to some people, but I write them with one governing principle in mind, which is I'm making a promise to my readers, and that if they do me the honor of clicking on that post, then I should keep my promise. So if I tell you that this is like a game-changing way to cut your mango, and you open the post and it's like some like trash you've seen everywhere else, then I didn't keep my promise, and you shouldn't trust me. And then I didn't actually provide you service. And a lot of people are not doing that on the internet in particular. And so, you know, you do get this big corral of people that are not, you know, standing in their integrity and their journalism. They're not truly providing service. And so, you know, it's easy to feel like something that feels like soft journalism, like food service journalism, you know, doesn't have space for that kind of, like, self-respect, honestly. But I don't operate that way, and I don't think that anyone who is like proud of what they're doing and is writing and producing work from a place of inherent value operates in that way. So under those sort of like, under those parameters, absolutely, I think that I hold myself and my team to those same standards. And you know, a part of working in food is not diminishing the level of integrity that you should bring to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think journalism is journalism.
Exactly.
It's the facts have to be facts. The part about food journalism that you didn't bring up that we sometimes forget because we're so focused on the story and the telling and the facts is, are you including recipes? And if you are, they have got to work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it is a really shocking fact that not that many people know that when you publish a cookbook, nobody tests those recipes. Nobody. No editor, no copy editor, no publisher. It is on you. So when you're writing a cookbook, I send it out to friends who love to cook, who I trust in the kitchen, but maybe are not as good, you know, or not as confident as I am. Most magazines have test kitchens, Eating Well tests every, you know, I've written for them and every recipe is tested and they are so specific. And that is food journalism also. And recipe writing is not discussed enough because it is a language unto itself and it is sometimes a very effective language, meaning it works. Meaning when you go home and take my recipe and spend whether it's $2 or $25 to make that dish, it better work. Otherwise, I've lost your trust forever. And I should lose your trust because that, so that is another language and another element of food journalism that is as important, and in some cases, I would venture to say almost more important, because many people don't read the articles, they go straight to the recipes.
This is also true with podcasting, too. I think a great podcast should be sort of very casual in tone, like sort of conversational. And the good thing about when you get to a conversation, a good conversation is you stop being self-conscious. But there are times when I'll listen to something that's come in where someone will kind of make a jab at a chef. If it's like, oh, you don't like the food, that's fine. But when people start making assumptions, then we'll have to sort of say, like, we'll have to cut that out. Because I do think that it's only fair to give that person an opportunity to respond. And so sometimes I'll say, well, actually, you know, this person isn't here. Let's just cut it out. And I think it's a better episode if you don't do that. And that's something that we've had to learn sort of the hard way. Like, we get probably about once a month an email from someone saying, so-and-so chef has a terrible reputation with women. We don't have the legal legal infrastructure or the money to sort of pursue something like that. Mm-hmm. So I do think that, I think I see a lot of podcasts sometimes get a little bit loosey-goosey with some of the journalism ethics. And so what we do with it, those things will naturally come up. Sometimes someone in a conversation will kind of go on a rant, and I encourage people to do that, but generally we try to cut them out in the actual final product, unless we've given that person an opportunity to respond. So that's what I mean by being fair. I'm not sort of being fair like, oh, we're going to get everyone of all different viewpoints on our show. Like, no, I don't really care about getting, like, Trump supporters on our show, and I make no apologies for that. I don't want to, they have their own platform. What I mean by fair is, if someone is going to, like, make a dig at Andy Ricker in Portland, a white chef who runs a Thai restaurant, then I should reach out to Andy. And I know that Andy would appreciate that. So that's sort of what I mean by being fair. So, you know, we call it the Andy Ricker rule. Don't go after people unless you need to, you know, because I think that's not what we're about, you know?
Do you want to add anything, Vaughn, to that?
I always have something to say.
Well, if you don't, I mean, but we can move on to
yeah,
the
I
voice,
think what
though.
What resonates with me about this, which is just a personal experience that I had recently that I feel like kind of brings all of what you said together, is something that I witnessed in practice. So I've had the tremendous privilege of having a reporter who I respect tremendously from the New York Times come to my house a couple weeks ago to cook with me for an article that they're writing about my book. And I know this person very mildly, and you know, like, but she came to my house as a reporter, even though we had met personally. And she arrived, and her process of the way that she asked me about every component of what I was doing, ultimately I was making homemade coconut milk from scratch in an apartment without a machete or a sledgehammer or even a cleaver. I don't own a cleaver, which doesn't make sense to me, but anyway. That can be corrected. And along the way, she was just asking me these really specific questions. Why that tool? Why, okay, so you go under it exactly how? And, you know, we worked together for over an hour, like, talking about, and I was like, this is a tricky thing about, in particular, when you cook from, like, traditional foods that don't belong to what I like to call the fist of salt. Right, like the fist of salt school of cooking, where you're just like, I don't know, bah, like that. when you start to share those recipes and those techniques with broader audiences, then you do have to do the work of going back and being like, okay, what exactly is the right process? And then after like spending an hour together and going through the process, I had a fact checker call me and we had an hour-long conversation where we went through line by line every single little component. Okay, is it accurate to say that the shell is like this? Is it accurate to say that the meat is like this? And then you peel the meat. And I was like, well, yes, you peel the meat, but the meat actually has a layer of skin on it. I think it's important for people to know that that's a different color than the white. So anyway, my reflection on that is that, you know, of course, this is the New York Times and they hold themselves to a particular standard. For those of us who don't write for the Times, who don't have the resources to do that level of fact checking, the onus is then on you to do that level of work on your own. And I think it's really important.
And I would just follow up more broadly and say that not just talking about home recipes or home stories or whatever, but specificity is so important when you're talking about food, when you're talking about really any subject as a journalist. It's very easy to make broad, sweeping generalizations, mm-hmm. but that doesn't really serve your audience well, and it doesn't really advance what you're doing. So really drilling down, getting those details, both in terms of what the facts are and describing. What does it look like? What is a person, what's their demeanor? What are they wearing? Where are they? What's the setting? You know, all these things help to create a picture in the reader or the listener's mind about what this story really is. And so just want to emphasize that specificity and facts are really important. And when you're out doing an interview or recording or whatever, take note of lots of things, not just those, you know, 10 questions that you wrote down on the pad before you, but really look around and think about what does it look like here? What does it feel like here? So that you can go back and create that scene for your audience.
Can I speak to that a little bit? I want to share this thing that like I sort of encountered as an editor, as the person who was acquiring stories and then editing them and also publishing them. I do not believe that every story needs to be for everyone. I do not believe that at all. And this really goes back to the specificity thing. So, you know, as you're doing your reporting, I think that, especially on the internet, good Lord, like everyone thinks that everyone should click on it and everyone should read it and everyone should find value in it. But that is actually the beauty of the internet, is that there's this giant platform for you to write a story for who you want to tell a story to or on behalf of. And one thing that I would encourage you to do is be very clear about that when you're pitching, by saying like who this is for and who you're writing this on behalf of, and also being unapologetic in how you're executing it. You can't go out and say that this is for this community and then hedge all the way through your pitch or your piece, because then you're not really pitching that for anyone. Like at the end of the day, it's like, who is this for? So like the specificity is important from the point of concept, when you're figuring out what the story is, what you're noticing in the story, all the way to the pitching of it. And then for the publishing, and for me as an editor, it makes my job a breeze, because I know who it's for, I know how to title it, and I know, you know, what to edit in and what to edit out and what to ask for. But if I'm taking a story that someone like started off this way, but at the end of it, you know, they decided that maybe it was too risky, and especially if you're writing for and about immigrant populations, that happens. Mm-hmm. It descends into like, this is hard for me to do at the end of it, because you're worried that it's not going to land somewhere. It will land somewhere, but you have to be 100% unapologetic from the beginning.
Hallie, I just wanted to hope you would talk about something that had a huge impact on me in terms of food and sort of the words we use and translating those words or not.
Yeah. If I'm writing or publishing a story for a certain population, for an example, I'm running a bunch of Ramadan content right now. I don't explain certain terms because that's not for people who need it to be explained to. So I don't explain iftar. I don't explain, you know, why this set of recipes is, you know, going to include dates. I don't explain all of that. And sometimes if we use words that are part of a certain tradition, I don't translate them because the assumption is that I'm translating them for a different audience, and then that signifies that that's not for the audience that I intended that piece to be for. So that's just a way to be like direct and unapologetic in the way that you're serving certain communities. And just as we talk about food journalism, I think it's really easy to talk about reporting on immigrants and refugees, but also write stories for them. Write to them, tell them their own stories. A lot of it is about, you know, telling the other about them. And I feel like the service that we can provide as journalists and as editors is to make them an equal part of the audience. And I find a lot of value in that. And I think this community has the opportunity to do that in a really like precise and respectful way.
I'd like to shift gears now and talk about voice. And Vaughn, you really started the conversation about that with your description of your approach. And so I'd like to bring the other members of the panel in and just, again, a very simple question. What is voice? What is a voice? And how do you develop the voice? I don't know who'd like to start.
Maybe. I'll go first because I was thinking about it when we were all introducing ourselves, and it occurred to me that every single one of you in your very brief introductions had incredible voices. There was such a distinct sense of, oh, this is who you are, this is where you're from, this is where you're headed, this is what you want. I don't know why I'm going to bring up an elevator again, but imagine that you're in an elevator, or the airplane is even more claustrophobic. You're sitting next to that person, and they start in, oh, I'm from Des Moines, and I have six grandchildren, and I've worked in the same job, and you're just like, please let this end, let me fall asleep, or let me, that's a voice that's not drawing you in. And then on the other side of you is someone that starts to tell you a story about what it was like to grow up in Detroit and be the only Japanese person in their school or the only Jew in their community or whatever their story is, and you want more. So what is that? What is it that that person is presenting to you that makes you want to ignore this guy and totally focus on that story? That's voice, that's storytelling. That is your ultimate job as a journalist, is to use your voice and make it really true to who you are. Now that is a very lofty goal, and it is always my goal, but certainly in a 40-year career, there are many, many publications that say, no, you have to use our voice. We are a brand, you need to speak like us. And you need to put in a few years of that. Now with the internet and with blogging and with podcasting and with all the potential voices and possibilities, it's easier to say, I don't want to talk Bon Appetit talk, or I don't want to talk Better Homes. And you know, I'm just throwing these things out. But everybody has a formula that works for them, and they ask you to fit within that. And what you need to do is find out how much of your voice you can actually use in the telling of your story for a publication or a radio station that has a very specific voice of its own and format. And I have found that there are ways to do it even when they tell you they don't want it. And it doesn't mean that it's first person, but it means that you describe something in a very distinct way. Details are so much a part of voice. I threw out the word texture because I've spent the last 15 years talking about food on radio, which makes a lot of people laugh because they think you can't see it. You can't take. I'm bringing food that I've made into a studio with these hosts of this NPR show with 5 million people listening, and they're saying yum, and that gives you nothing. So it's my job to tell the story about that food so that you could close your eyes right now and you could see it. maybe you could taste it, but in your mind's eye, maybe you talk about texture, which I feel food writers never talk about. Being in radio has made me so attuned to texture. What kind of crunch is it? What kind of snap is it? And when you look at food from other unexpected things like sound and texture, you start to expand your food vocabulary and develop a voice that's not like the guy next to you. So it's all about being true to yourself, but also exploring new ways. If you find yourself saying delicious or beautiful, you know, you just know you're in trouble. Like, how else can I say it? What is it about this mouthful of food, or why I brought you this dish, or why I'm telling you this story that makes it worth listening to? That's voice.
Just add on that. I think it's easier to define what is not voice. So I worked in politics for many years, and one of the things that we'd say is that when we want to bury something, we would use the most generic language possible. So for example, like if I do a pre-interview with a chef and they say something like, or someone in the food world, they're like, well, I think what we need to do is bring people together. I'm like, just kill me now. I mean, that's terrible. Just like, that is the worst shit ever. Or love trumps hate. Like, oh my God, just stop, okay? Celebrate diversity. Gosh, please, like, awful. But if someone says something with a very strong opinion and is willing to take a risk, I mean, look at Bourdain. Bourdain, very famously in that New Yorker piece, made fun of vegetarians. Now, I don't think it was a fair dig at vegetarians, but it was a voice. It was a perspective. And he later corrected himself, you know, when he did his episode in India. Like, that's what I really look for, is someone who's willing to take some risks. Now, I think when you take a risk, it's not that you want to be, like, going on a rant about all these chefs that they don't like, but someone who says, has a very strong point of view, and will say, I don't like the way that, you know, this publication will treat, you know, Vietnamese writers, for example. You know, someone who's really strong. So that's what I always look for, someone who's willing to take a risk. Generally, we get approached by a lot of chefs or cookbook writers, and they'll send me pitches, and they're just so boring. And they're just like, I think we need to be more positive. And I'm like, I agree, but that's not for us. Because I want something that's a little bit bold. I also want someone who's willing how should I say this? Maybe this is not the right word, but willing to offend a little bit. I mean, there are some things that we have to say that are uncomfortable. I do believe food brings us together, but myself as an Indian American, I have really painful experiences of people making fun of my food.
Yeah.
I have a lot of shame about food. I would bring the food my mom would make to school and I would be made fun of. I'm in my 40s now. It's taken me a long time to say, I love Indian food. I love cooking Indian food. But so I don't want someone who's just gonna say food always brings us together. It does. You're right. Many times. Last night was a wonderful example. Those who were at the dinner, but it can also be tricky. People feel shame around body image and something like that. So I want someone who's gonna say something kind of bold. To me, that's voice. Take a risk.
How much time do we have, John? Just curious.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So quick anecdote, and I'll talk a little bit more about my book project and like how it came to be and what it is and all that stuff a little bit later, but I feel like finding my voice, which sounds like the most cliche thing that writers ever talk about, and it's so nebulous, and it sounds so fluffy, is just such an incredibly difficult thing, and it's a really individual and unique process. And actually, I'm so delighted to say that Kathy and John together helped me find my voice as a food writer and were the first editors of my very first piece of food writing that I ever wrote in the entire world, and it was for Feet in Two Worlds. And the part of the process for me was that, as I told y'all earlier, like all of y'all, obsessed with food, super fascinated by it. And I would do a lot of writing exercises because I'm a dork. And I would just be like, I'm just going to write this little paragraph. And everything I wrote was so trite. It was so boring. It was riddled with words like community and savory and delicious and crunch. And, you know, it was just, I don't know, like I couldn't find it. And then I don't know exactly what happened, but I found this in my observation of a lot of other people's writings. Your writing, if that's what you do, or your photography, or your video, your audio piece, it should sound like someone is in the room with you. And it should, like, when you're reading something that I write, I want you to feel like I'm telling you the story. And the process of getting there takes time for all of us to, like, write and write and write and really distill and get away from these cliches and get away from these buzzwords and find a way to combine the way you actually talk in the world with what you want to communicate. So for me, talking about like translations and things, I was, again, born in Puerto Rico, raised in the South, spoke mostly Spanish at home as a kid, and went back and forth a lot. So I live a bilingual life. Like, my mind works bilingually. There are some words that I absolutely cannot figure out how to say in English. I don't think they make as much sense, and they don't sound as beautiful. When I write for food publications, and as I was working through my book, I made personal decisions about what I thought needed to be translated, like the word pollo. Everybody knows what pollo is, right? Like, I don't need to translate pollo as chicken, you know? And just little things like huepa, that's an expression, you know, like, woo. And I took my cues from that, and forgive me mentioning him because I know that he's in a bit of trouble right now, but Junot Diaz's book, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, was one of the first places where I saw someone vacillating between Spanish and English, and English in a way that felt like there was a flow. Like it wasn't, like I didn't feel like pulled out of the piece. I was like, oh, maybe I don't know what that word means. But then the next word would sort of articulate what was coming next. So I think that people really like voicey writers. You know, if you're writing for the most, I don't know, you know, even Eater, but, you know, if you're writing sort of like, I don't know, for, what is this public, The Infatuation, right, in New York, which, like, tells you about all this, like, random shit you should eat. It's just really standard, you know, like, I don't know that reporter, I don't feel like I know where they're from. They gave me some information, and then they put it on the internet. But I think that, you know, people, especially as someone who writes largely in a personal essay memoir style, even in my like, reported pieces, like, people don't want to hear about me, but they do want to hear what I think. You know, and I think that that's particularly as someone who comes from a community that we don't hear from that often. So, yeah, I mean, I guess partly I want to encourage all of y'all to really hone your casual voice, like the way you talk to your best friend, and use that as the way that you then share. And, you know, like, I mean, like Zahir said, sometimes that's like a little bit risky, but I think it's far more interesting.
Don't you think it has to do with confidence?
Yeah, I don't know. That's an interesting way to think about it.
Permission.
I just remember being a really young writer and doubting every word. Yeah. And I would have John edit, and I'd have other people edit. And I'm like, and I just sort of neuter myself because I didn't feel like my voice was worthy. And I didn't trust and have the confidence. Do you have
that? I can't, I'm sorry to cut in, but I can't help but feel like that's also gendered, and it's about culture and race and identity and where you come from and whether or not you have models for success that you can model your own writing on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just want to offer like a few concrete tips. One thing that like when I used to come to like workshops and stuff and still go to them, and we talk about these things, and you know, it's really easy to get super abstract, but like I sometimes like need somebody to give me like an actual exercise to do to like get to a place. So I found that record yourself, read a piece of your writing, and every time you hear yourself sound like you, because you know when you hear it, write it down. And what ends up happening if you engage in this practice is that you're gonna start overhearing yourself saying things you did not know you knew. Because oftentimes when you're in that flow state of writing, like you hit your truths and you don't even know that they're your truths until you almost, you need to hear them being said back to you. So that's one of the like most formative things I've done as a writer. It's to read my own work back to myself and then highlight when I sound it like me. And then, you know, branch out from there. Ask people who you know you and your voice, or at least their opinion about that is important to you. Ask your mom, ask your friends, whomever. I think it's really important as you're forming your voice as a writer, to go out into the world, not looking for the world to fill you up with their answers of who you are, but for people to confirm what you already know. So you have to go to your trusted places. And I think that's probably one of the best practices you can engage in to figure out what your writing is. Because if you do not describe food with the word delicious and you slide it into a piece, you're gonna know if that's not your word. And I think, you know, as you go out and try to place pieces into this like giant world of food writing, this is your opportunity to be distinct. So I wouldn't squander it by like skipping the little bit of work that you have to do ahead of time. And like Vaughn was saying before, like that kind of stuff is joyous, right? Like if you are a writer, you're a photographer, you're making audio, you know, doing the like the homework basically to get to where you are should feel good. And if it doesn't feel good, that tells you something as well.
Okay, let's turn it over to you and your questions. And if you would use the microphone, that would be awesome. So then we will record this.
Thank you. Kathy, this is a question for you. You talked about texture, and I began to study wine, and I've developed like a stronger palate and a willingness to make up words. How did you develop your texture vocabulary when you began writing?
By listening. So when I first started doing food on the radio, I actually cooked live. So when Here and Now first started, they would do the news headlines, and then they would run to the kitchen, literally, the host would leave the studio, run to the kitchen, and I would be starting a very sound-centric dish. So no pasta, and then we would start the dish, and at the end of the show, they'd come back, and in real time, I would have cooked it, and it would just be finished up, and then they would do the yum yum. But so what did I learn? I learned that when you chop a parsnip, it's really, really different than chopping a supermarket carrot. Mm. There's a different sound. A parsnip is much harder. It has less water. It has a much crisper cut. Mm. I found that actually boiling water does have a sound, you know, whether it's glunk, glunk, or whatever words you need to put to it. But by not being focused on the taste or the sight, and just trying to think, like I'd cook a dish at home and I'd be like, there's no sound happening. You know, like a really hot saute is awesome on the radio. Yeah. Because there's just, you know, there's the oil heating up and there's the splat of the food going in. And I don't know, sometimes it's like describing a cartoon, you know, splat, dunk, clunk, hot, you know, like you just have to have fun with the words too. And you just, yeah. I often close my eyes and say, no one sees this. How do I let them see it? Yeah. Does that answer it?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Can I add to that? So I like manage a team of recipe developers, and I cannot tell you how many times they just tell me something's delicious, which like means nothing to me. I make them read like car magazines. I make them read fashion magazines. Like get out of food, you know, go expand your experience of how other people are describing other things and then bring that back with you. I mean, this like speaks very well to this idea of like, what are your interdisciplinary interests? And take from one thing, like if you're totally into music, like what's the language of music? Bring it to food.
Well, that's good.
You know, because like when we read a ton of food writing, we all start sounding the same. So like get out of food and like cleanse your palate and come back and write your thing.
Also, if you sit in restaurants and listen to the things people say, we've become very dumb. Well, you alternate, like you'll hear people take a bite of something, they'll be like, right? You know, or they'll say, I told you, what? Right? Like that's their code for like, isn't this blowing your mind? So you have to translate that. And then there are the people in the restaurants who are like, oh, the nuance of earthiness, you know, like they're all wine experts and you just want to shoot yourself. It's like, talk about the food as it's happening to you. Don't pretend you're someone.
It's just more like a comment, just what you guys are saying really resonates with me. I know I said earlier I have a background in journalism, so I started out mostly doing business journalism. So I wrote for Black Enterprise, Essence, Wall Street Journal. So, you know, very businessy articles, very newsy feature stories. So when I been going, since I decided to transition into food journalism, that was a big thing for me, trying to find and understand my voice. And I know Serena and Vaughn will know what I'm talking about. Davita Davison raves about Tunde Wei's writing, and she always says, when I read him, like, I know it's him, because I can tell by his voice. Yeah. So just from hearing her say that, like, it's really, like, pushed me to try to develop my own voice. But thank you, Haley, for your tips, because I was wondering that too, like, what specifically can you do to do that? And I just wanted to say, I got a book called Will Write for Food, and it talks about what you were talking about, Kathy, like those different ways to describe food. And they have exercises in there, so just personally.
One quick comment, and then I want to hear what you had to say, just because Hallie and I were talking about this yesterday. There's a beautiful documentary on Netflix about Maya Angelou. Maybe y'all have seen it, maybe you haven't, maybe you don't know it's there. There is something about the way that she talks about how she came to writing that made me feel so, it was so gentle, and it was so lovely and warm. And I feel like sometimes it feels like a lot of pressure to, like, find your voice and have this unique perspective. And, like, I just want to encourage folks who are in your position to be gentle with yourself, because it's like there's no timeline, and it takes actually like a lot of self-reflection and vulnerability to get to the place where you're authentically yourself in a way that you then share with the public. So lean on Maya, because she has a lot. She makes you feel good.
That's good.
You mentioned Tunde Wei. For those who don't know, Tunde Wei was actually a poet and did a lot of spoken word, and I think that says a lot about. So I think when we think about trying to improve as a food writer or a podcaster or whatever your medium is, also go outside the medium of food writing. Pick up a novel, pick up a short story collection, pick up a poetry book. The second thing I want to add, something that Aaron said in the previous panel, we talked about narrative. He's looking for a narrative when he gets a pitch. To add on to that, also there should be an emotional core. I think what's so great about Tunde Wei's pieces and a lot of other great food writers is there is some emotional core to it. And that's something that we're always looking for in an episode. Like, what is the emotion behind this? What is the person longing for, missing, wanting? And I think that's something that's a real good food story should have that. Tejal Rowe wrote a piece in the New York Times about a food cart worker who really wanted to go on vacation in the Caribbean. And could never afford it. And that was such a wonderful section of this piece, that he aspires for something but can't afford it as a food cart worker.
Just really quickly, also, I do an exercise sometimes when I'm teaching food writing where I just have you go to a memory through smell and only smell. And it's incredible how emotional those pieces become when people are focused on that single scent. You know, I was in a workshop once, and an older woman wrote a story about walking down Fifth Avenue during the Second World War, and at Lord & Taylor's, there was a perfume fountain. And the idea was that you ran your handkerchief through this fountain, and so you had this something nice to smell when the world was falling apart. Mm. And she wept as she wrote this and told us, and we all did too, because it was so real. Yeah. Just thinking about, like, a perfume fountain during wartime. So it's another way to get outside of your brain.
I have one last thing. I'm sorry, I know y'all have questions. I can't help but mention this. So last week I was at the Healthy-ish Homecoming, which is one of Bon Appetit's new brands. It's all about kind of wellness. I have a lot of feelings about it. We could talk about it later over lunch. But the panelists for that conference were so stellar and so diverse and so fascinating that it blew my mind. But I ended up meeting a woman named Cleo Zulli, who does a series of food convenings in New York, and she's doing something talking about voice and sort of pulling this conversation out of simply writing and photography and media spaces to like how else you can articulate your voice. I'm going to read something she sent me. So her organization is called the Black Palette. And just this week, she hosted something called a lunch counter. And she says, our menu pays homage to the 1960s Woolworth civil rights lunch counter sit-ins while raising awareness about what happened on April 22nd, 2018 to Chicana Clemens, a young woman who was physically, what is this word, exposed as she was violently arrested and inhumanly treated as a diner at an Alabama Waffle House. There's more in this thing, but I was so struck by how her voice, her background came through in this event that she was hosting, because ultimately, like, all of her is showing up in this incredible social justice food space, and it's articulated really clearly so you know what the experience is going to be. So anyway, couldn't help but mention it.
I was just wondering, what are some of your favorite examples of really great food journalism with voice, both particular pieces and outlets that you see it consistently coming out of? Because I always want a reading list, so.
Kathy Gunst,
oh,
Zaheer,
stop.
And Hallie.
True story.
I sometimes like to even go back to MFK Fisher. Very spare, but very real voice, very foundational. Who else?
I absolutely adore Monique Truong. Her The Book of Salt,
Book of Salt
is one of the most beautiful and devastating pieces of food writing I've ever read.
But it's a novel.
Yeah, but it's a novel. And then she wrote another book about someone who has sensophilia that's equally good.
Since we're in Detroit, I recommend everyone look for a woman here by the name of Davita Davison.
Davison, and if you haven't already, check out her TED Talk. She's my hero. She runs Detroit. She's incredible. But she's someone who has such a strong point of view and is amazing. And I love that. She, to me, is the definition of voice. It's a tremendous amount of conviction, tremendous amount of passion, and razor-sharp precision in her words. Davita is just amazing. She's doing the Dream Cafe, so look for her.
And I know Aaron's been putting together a list of writers and pieces, and we can add to that, because I'd actually like to give that some thought. There's so many.
Like, yeah.
I mean, I'm like, I can think of 20 people, but I want to be careful about it.
Can I also say, though, that, oh, man, just I feel like it, a lot of food writing sounds the same.
Yeah.
It does. And especially, like, on the national media scene, where everybody's so damn safe in their food writing, it really does all sound the same, and you're writing, you know, I'm a little jaded because I've only ever worked in like national media. So there's a lot of like writing that like is palatable for brands and advertising, which is just like boring as fuck. But when I go back and read like early editor's letters of like Ruth Reichel, like early gourmet, that stuff is like electrifying to me.
It's gone.
It does not exist. It does not exist. I mean, that's like how I got into magazines. I read editor's letters and I was like, wow, this is gorgeous. Like early Saveur, that kind of stuff, like where culture and food were really the reason they were doing it, not ad dollars.
Old collections of the best American food writing have some great stuff in it. You'll find new voices and old voices there as well.
And also people who don't name themselves as food writers. And when they write about food, I really enjoy it. John McPhee, he has a book called Oranges, where he just basically reported on oranges. It's called Oranges. It's brilliant. You know, he's not a food writer, and he's writing about food. And it's just, like, refreshing.
I'll add to the collection, but a few people that really stand out to me, even though he's an older white man, Mark Kurlansky is such a genius at taking a single...
And researcher.
Yeah, he's so brilliant at taking a single ingredient and just taking you all the way back in time and through. And he has a new book that I haven't read yet. There is a brilliant writer who is a colleague and a good friend named Osai Endelin. She is currently the managing editor for Gravy, which is the Southern Foodways Alliance's publication. She just won a James Beard Award, and she is phenomenal and so voicey. She wrote a brilliant piece about, she writes about cocktails, which is also very unusual to have women of color in the cocktail writing space. And she wrote a brilliant article about plantation pineapple rum and about like what it felt like for her to love a rum that was called Plantation, and it was just beautifully done. John T. Edge, you know, forevermore is like a really brilliant writer. Dr. Jessica B. Harris has been writing in food space for a very, very long time. And I will add to the Google Doc.
We can send a list out.